So, yeah, I just encourage people to get in touch with us. We've been having such a great time doing outreach in like 20 over 25 cities. So we're small, but we're growing, and I hope you can be a part of it.
Great. Thanks so much, Wendy, for joining us today on Prison Pipeline.
Thank you so much.
Hi, this is Emma. I am a co-host here at KABU. At KABU, we prove every day that people-powered radio has the ability to bring us together across distances and give us hope when we feel despair. Your friends at KABU want to remind you that generosity has the same power. Join thousands of KABU supporters from all around the world, and let's rally together to build stronger communities. If you can, just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number 44321. And thanks so much for your support of KBOO Community Radio.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
This is Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars. And you're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations of programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the first Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kabu.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KABU Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
Back then, it was really hard. It was often dismissed as local street gang activity. It was dismissed as harmless graffiti. But by doing effective and long-term research and organizing on it, you could show the larger community that this was, in fact, politically motivated, that it was designed to harass and intimidate Jews and people of color. It was designed to bring about the kind of society that white supremacists had dreamed of. And you could also then expose people to the larger networks and organizations that were providing aid and support. That was effective in getting more people to take the stuff seriously, from city government to law enforcement to everyone else. Removing it from simply a fight for the streets to making it a fight for the kind of heart and soul of the entire city.
That's Devin Burghardt, a member of the Coalition for Human Dignity, who today investigates right-wing fascism at the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. He reminds us that the research the coalition did spread the fight against neo-Nazis to different realms outside of the streets and shows of Portland. I'm Selena Flores.
And I'm Mike Crenshaw, your host for this episode of It Did Happen Here. We talk more about the research capacity of the CHD in this episode, but first we'll hear about how the research arm of the CHD contributed to an international effort to shut down a peddler of anti-Semitic revisionist history. Here's Steve Wasserstrom, professor of Judaic Studies and the Humanities at Reed College and a member of the Coalition for Human Dignity.
One of the things that happened was that things started to accelerate and they kind of converged and got more intense from the mid-80s through the mid-90s. There was the militia movement, there's the KKK, and then you had religiously tinged groups like Christian Identity. These were deeply anti-Semitic and anti-Black. And then there were neo-pagan groups. There was one called Asatru, and they were quite active and were also on the far right. And then there were international intruders like David Irving from London. And so there was quite a variety of kinds of activities. There was a lot of agitation. And these things all sort of fed into each other. And that led to a sense of public alarm. And it led to groups that we organized, like the Coalition for Human Dignity, the Northwest Coalition Against Malicious Harassment, and other groups who were realized that more needed to be done than was being done by the authorities.
Again, here's Jonathan Mazzocchi.
David Irving, English-based popular history writer. First and foremost, he's a Holocaust denier. He's an anti-Semite, and in the 1980s and 1990s, he was one of very few somewhat academic neo-Nazis who provided a link between street-level racists and, well, academics, and more and a more professional class. So Irving would tour in countries that would allow him in. And talk about how World War II was not about the destruction of European Jews. It was actually just a response to Stalin and really nasty stuff.
In the early 90s, Irving went on an international lecture circuit to promote claims that, for example, gas chambers did not exist at Auschwitz. As a result, several European countries, including Germany, Austria, and Italy, barred Irving from entering.
In any case, he was an important figure in fascist international networks. In Portland, in the early 90s, he was hosted by an attorney, also happened to run a racist pagan group, white people who were worshiping pagan idols or whatever. It was an Asatru group is what they called themselves. So they had some access to money and some access to some professional organizing. They could talk to the media without having swastikas painted on their foreheads. And they were the ones who hosted Irving at a number of events that they tried to hold and a couple that they did successfully hold in the Pacific Northwest. And so we headed up the intelligence on who was hosting his event. And we found that it was racist skinheads who were doing security, racist skinheads who were doing promotions around Irving's speech and his appearances, and that this was the case in all over the United States and the speaking tour. So we managed to track his efforts pretty closely and then to disrupt them at a number of places.
So David Irving was increasingly active as a Holocaust denier on the international scene in the 80s. Some of these local groups, we know who they were, invited him to come repeatedly to Portland. They would organize these by word of mouth. Somebody would have to find out, and we had people who could find out where these events took place, and then we would organize demonstrations just to cause as much attention to make life as difficult for them as possible.
When Steve Wasserstrom talks here about people who could find out, he's referencing the research capacity of the CHD, the strengths of the organization. The coalition routinely sent agents into neo-Nazi meetings to collect intelligence, learning where fascists were hosting events, gaining entry into their events, finding out the dates and times of engagements, things like that.
We couldn't and wouldn't and never did debate them. There was a universal consensus among people who work with these kind of groups that you don't debate Holocaust deniers. If you debate them, then you give them a legitimacy. So we weren't going to do that. But short of that, we could bring people out to their events and let people see that they were in their community and they were organizing the community.
We found out that he was coming back to Portland to teach. And we found out that Mount Hood Community College had given them their speaking room. there was a Oregonian editor at the time named Phil Stanford. He started writing in our newspaper about how maybe we should listen to this guy, David Irving. You know, maybe he's right. Maybe not that many people died during the Holocaust. This is in our Oregonian prime, first thing on the column. So we had to then organize in a broad base of all faith communities, all political communities, and start answering that editorial.
Abby Layton of the Coalition for Human Dignity talks about an important aspect of academic fascism: draping lies in the cloth of free speech rights. Journalist Phil Stanford at the time was a Metro columnist for The Oregonian, Portland's daily newspaper. Stanford disagreed with the practice mentioned by Professor Wasserstrom, that Holocaust survivors, scholars, and activists do not debate Holocaust deniers and do not allow them to speak in their communities.
Irving and other fascists consistently portray themselves as victims, being denied free speech, despite proof from many legitimate historians that Irving's so-called history is full of errors and designed to spread a message of deep anti-Semitism. We see this reflected today as the far right mounts a crusade against cancel culture, where politicians and pundits who routinely promote hate speech evade accountability by declaring themselves to be victims of hate. Stanford seems to have fallen for Irving's claim that he was a historian. The academic veneer that Mazzocchi describes was enough to gain support of the influential local columnists. Here's an excerpt from one of the columns Abby mentions, written September 25th, 1992.
At least as far as I know, Irving is not a neo-Nazi sympathizer. He is a British historian who has published a number of controversial works on World War II, and along the way has said some pretty upsetting things about the Holocaust. In fact, he questions whether the number of Jews killed by the Nazis is as great as most historians say. In other words, he's what people in the history business call a revisionist. He doesn't deny that huge numbers of Jews and others died under the Nazis. However, he puts the number at something closer to 1 million. Is he right? Is he wrong? Personally, I wasn't there doing the counting, so I don't know. As far as I'm concerned, 100 would have been too many.
He went on to write two more. He stuck to his place. So what we did proactively, besides organizing every community and getting it seen, so what we did was we did a four-day symposium and we revealed him. But then what we did not, you know, just let it go by. We went out there and did a peaceful demonstration at Portland Community when he was actually speaking at Portland Community. We stood there and sang and had presence. There's over 200 people. And, of course, the police showed up in all of their riot gear and belly clubs against us.
The police are protecting them and ushering them. And there was literally threats of violence. Law enforcement organizations came out in larger force and kept them separate. But part of the effect is that they have protection. I'm not saying, oh, we should unleash violence in the streets. But I'm concerned with the way that law enforcement have been managing these events in such a way that these folks feel protected and comfortable coming back.
In 1993, Dr. Deborah Lipsett, a professor of modern Jewish history and Holocaust studies, published Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Truth and Memory, in which she named David Irving as a Hitler partisan who manipulated the historical record in an attempt to portray his hero in a favorable light. 3 years later, David Irving sued Dr. Lipstadt and her publisher Penguin Books for libel, which resulted in a month-long trial in English courts. In American courts, defendants are presumed innocent until proven guilty, but at the time, English law was the opposite. Professor Lipstadt was required to provide proof that her statement was factual. The 5-year legal battle was described as putting history on trial, and the CHD played a small but important role in that.
So when Irving was brought to trial, they had to demonstrate that he was, in fact, a neo-Nazi, an extreme right-wing activist. So they collected witness statements from a number of us from around North America who had actually heard his events and what he had to say, and I submitted one of those, and he was convicted.
Wasserstrom submitted a sworn affidavit with observations he made while attending the Irving event at Mount Hood Community College. Statements Irving made, descriptions of the neo-Nazis who provided security, the racist pagan who introduced him, intelligence that had been collected and stored in the famous filing cabinets of the CHD's research wing. It's an effective example of how opposition research can have lasting impact that we may not understand at the time, and a good reminder to archive our histories. Irving's reputation as a historian was thoroughly destroyed. He was sued into bankruptcy and he lost his home. He is not without continued support. He continues to travel and speak, but resistance to his toxic message also continues. In 2019, for example, he was banned from entering Lithuania until 2024.
We don't want these folks in our downtown, in the courthouse square or anywhere on the street, spewing their hate. And in many cases, we're talking about groups who are literal neo-Nazis or virtual neo-Nazis. We're talking about hardcore hate organized and marching in our streets. What people can do is show up. Rose City Antifa and other groups who are monitor these groups, make clear when they're going to have rallies, bookmark those sites and find out when events are coming and show up. My ideal would be that many, many more Portlanders of good faith would show up at these events than these activists and never let them come and have any degree of comfort spouting hate in our streets. And there's lots of other kind of work to do, academic work and scholarly work and political work of all kinds, but they organize intentionally to come to the streets. I think it's important for our community to show up in as large a number as possible. Folks who, you know, who work actively in this area do not like, generally, shy away from comparisons with the 1930s in Germany. We are hearing those more and more now. And while I think that's still alarmist, we do know that there are precedents of increasing authoritarianism, and this kind of street hate activism is part of a package of a slide into authoritarianism. It's not clear how many folks have had their consciousness raised sufficiently to understand how much closer we're getting to that world, and therefore how much more work everybody needs to do to stop it. To the extent that we know that somebody is already fully committed to agendas that are tantamount to white nationalism, I'm not sure how much more conversation is necessary. Resistance is in order after a certain point. I think we do need to be very concerned about the contemporary situation. It's closely connected to international developments, particularly in Eastern and Western Europe. And so it's partly being driven from abroad. We need to be aware of that and keep our eyes open.
Coalition for Human Dignity struggled constantly to communicate the dual threat posed by Christian fundamentalists and white nationalists. No one, it seemed, would take seriously the intelligence, which consistently indicated that combined, these two right-wing movements could shake democracy to the core.
The Coalition for Human Dignity had two unique contributions. First was to recognize that the vigilante far right, that the threat of an American form of fascism, would come through the Christian right and the white supremacist movement. And while that doesn't sound provocative or in any way controversial today, back then actually was, because most groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League and other mainstream, more liberal groups really treated those two movements very differently. So their focus tended to be on the white supremacist movement, the Ku Klux Klan, racist skinheads, militia groups, so on and so forth. anti-LGBTQ stuff was not considered hate group activity. The racist anti-immigrant work was also not considered, broadly speaking, hate group activity. So one of the things we argued very early on was that actually you need to take a look at both of these political trends within the far right. When you look at them, it becomes very apparent that in order to achieve any kind of broader equality, in order to move forward, we need to fight both of those political currents. So that's what we did. And if you look at the Coalition for Human Dignity's research, you'll see very early on that we made a distinction between these two political currents, but also said that they had to be struggled against. Again, you really had organizations fighting one or the other, but not both.
A major strength of the Coalition for Human Dignity was their willingness and resilience to experiment with their tactics. Stephen Gardner outlines the process.
We'll try this, we'll try that. And to then say, okay, we think this will work, but we're not going to do this on our own. We can do research on our own, but we weren't trying to be right. We were trying to have an impact. And so then we would go to community organizations, usually the most impacted. That might be the Jewish community, if this is a Holocaust denial situation. Or the Black community, if this is a situation with street intimidation, or the queer community, if this was a OCA thing, we would say, we're thinking about doing this. What do you think? Or what would be helpful to you? So we tried to do movement-facing partnerships to inform our activities. I wouldn't say that we always succeeded. I mean, a lot of us were pretty young back then who were involved. There's a certain arrogance of youth that sometimes made us think that we were smarter than everyone else. And we certainly spent a lot of time figuring things out about the right, reading their newsletters. And so in a certain sense, especially in a pre-internet time, we did know more about what was going on with the right than anyone else in the Northwest by virtue of having 14 filing cabinets full of their newsletters. That doesn't necessarily translate into winning. We won some fights and we lost others.
At the beginning of the last episode, Jason referred to his involvement with the research as a little obsessed. The mindset of the white nationalists became for some omnipresent in their actual lives, a virtual reality with hate at its core. This took a toll on the organizers who lived with regular death threats and harassment, while media and local agencies downplayed the threat of racist violence. Stephen Gardner explains the intimate relationship coalition activists had with the far-right world.
Who would routinely call me up and threaten my life, threaten my family. Not just me, this was other people in the organization as well, whoever they could get in touch with. That was the kind of organization we were in. We were constantly confronting and being confronted by political vigilantes who we knew to be violent.
Abby Layton gives us some more details.
My friend Jonathan, who taught me to stand up for myself, received a rat in the mailbox. It had been shot through the head. It said, "This will happen to you if you do any more of your work." I got letters and phone calls about twice a week for several years. Also, I got copies of the newsletters, the neo-Nazi newsletters that were sent out nationally. In those newsletters, my address and another one of my coworkers' addresses were on the newsletter saying, "Drop in, give her a visit. I'm sure she'd love to meet you." I was willing to risk my life doing this. And I don't know that I'm not really a big risk taker. It's just really super important to me, the work. Like after my daughter survived that attack, which she might not have, I was in shock for about a week. But then after that, I just sobbed. It was so scary to me. I've said over and over again to hold your own hand when you're scared. But I guess I want people to know that there's a great threat here, that these people really are dangerous. The work can get very, very scary. It can get very life and death. And I want to encourage each person to find their own place in it. Like, you don't have to be on the lines. You don't have to, you don't have to force yourself past where you feel at your edge. Just go to where your edge is. You know, that'll be enough.
For a small, poorly funded organization, CHD has left a powerful legacy. The work of the research activists lives on in many organizations who called on them for help, and in the lives of activists themselves. Throughout this podcast, we hear people referring to the work of the CHD as being hard work, but most of the CHD activists we interviewed about their experiences are fighting white supremacy and white nationalism today. When Devin Burkhart encountered the Coalition for Human Dignity at the meeting at Western Washington University, he could not have predicted the impact it would have on his life.
I've been working professionally on white nationalism for over 25 years now. I started at the Coalition for Human Dignity. And what's important about CHD is what an important role that that small Portland and Seattle-based organization played in helping shape the research capacity and the desire to do that work in other organizations, groups like the Montana Human Rights Network and the North Carolinians Against Racial and Religious Violence, and numerous other local groups were trained and supported by CHD back in those days. And it was CHD that, after my working with them for about 4 years, CHD got a call from an affiliated organization in Chicago who was just starting up, and they really wanted to add a research capacity. The group was called the Center for New Community. CHD gladly decided to volunteer me to go out there and work for a couple months to help them set up that organization and help them build their research capacity. And it was after doing that for a couple months, we decided that it would be best for me to stay on and help build up that organization. So in many ways, the work that the Center for New Community did for over two decades was in large part seeded and grown by the work that CHD and others were doing. And we couldn't have done it without their support and their training and the kind of vigilance that they provided on the ground. It really inspired that work and continues to inspire the work we do at the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights.
Today, in 2021, with the Bay of Chuds insurrection on the Capitol building last January, with no sight of consequences, with Proud Boys shooting protesters in the streets and Christian fundamentalists gaining mainstream political power and threatening basic reproductive and other human rights, researching far-right hate groups is just as urgent as when boneheads chased Abby Layton's daughter onto Mary Steiger's porch. Again, Jonathan Mazzocchi.
So today... groups are carrying that out through doxing, through deplatforming, and they're very effective, and they're effective in ways that we really never could be. And I have a great deal of respect for that work. I would say one thing, it's not a criticism, what we call signals intelligence or internet hacking, doing intelligence work online, is one form of research-driven politics. But the other form is human intelligence, where you actually have people go to their meetings, where people befriend these folks so that we can steal their membership lists, so we can have a better idea of what the internal culture of their politics are, what their political organizations are, so we can have an understanding of where their funding comes from, so we can track and monitor, for instance, when they're supporting a Trump candidacy, you know, months before the guy is going to run for office. We need to have that information. And one of the ways that's very effective in doing that is developing people to go and do that. Contemporary fight the right groups are far more effective at signals intelligence in utilizing the internet, but perhaps not quite as good as we were at developing people to infiltrate those groups. We need to do both.
And finally, a message to activists on the front lines today.
If there's anything that I would tell contemporary activists, it's really push the envelope. You're going to need to do this, because if you don't, you're relying on other outfits to do that intelligence gathering for you. And if they do it, then it's going to be their political interpretation of what that stuff means. You don't want that. We need to have control of our own intelligence. We need to have control of our own research. And that's what we did. We didn't rely on outside groups to come in and tell us what the threat was that we were facing. We did the research and we knew what it was. And therefore, we had a better means of a counterforce of organizing against it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of It Did Happen Here. The transcripts, show notes with links, full credits, and other relevant content can be found at our website, itdidhappenherepodcast.com. Interviews in this episode were conducted by Annette Newell, Claire Rigetto, Selena Flores, and Aaron Yankee, and your hosts were Selena Flores and Mike Crenshaw. This podcast is produced by Mike, Selena, and me, Aaron Yankee. Thanks to the participants for sharing their stories. Thanks also to the Institute for Anarchist Studies, PM Press, the Marla Davis Fund, KBOO Community Radio, and the rest of our production team, Icky A., Julie Perini, and Mo Baustern. And thank you for listening. Are tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Here goes nothing.
Tune in to KBOO for Drinking from Puddles, hosted by Brandon, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. That's Drinking for Puddles every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Yeah.
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
I'm going to own right here that I was actually born and raised pretty racist. I'm from a little teeny town where we rode bulls and uncles are cowboys and tote guns and all that stuff. But I didn't know any better. Like, I didn't have anyone around. But my aunt took in foster kids. I had a lot of foster cousins, some Hispanic, a couple young men from India. We were all together. We were all family. We were all brothers. We're all just people. We are no different. You're from here. You're from there. Everyone is flailing. Everyone's faking it till they make it. So as I was getting a little older, I started putting two and two together that actually the white power guys were creating a bunch of BS for everybody. So it really lost its power for me.
That was Michael Clark, who took what was called direct action to kick Nazi scum out of the Rose City. Welcome to episode 10 of It Did Happen Here, Sharper Times. I'm Selena Flores.
And I'm Mike Crenshaw. In this episode, we hear from the people who were part of SHARP, Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice.
You may remember Michael Clark from episode one.
13, 14, New Paradox, walking down Woodstock Boulevard.
His family moved from rural Oregon to Northeast Portland in the mid-80s, where he attended Grant and Madison High School.
Yelling at me, give up the boots, and
he was a teenage skater and punk rocker. Here he describes his world as a teenage punk in Portland back in the late 1980s.
There was a lot of racial violence in Portland at that time. I've witnessed shootouts with AK-47s in school parking lots and drive-bys and mass beatings and stabbings and all kinds of stuff. Also, gay bashing was very prominent down by Stark Street. Definitely a lot of crazy stuff. So late 80s, early 90s, I was already clean and sober. I quit drinking the first time at 13, so I was pretty much a straight edge little punk rock kid. I knew skinheads from being out at shows, and they hung out with all their white power buddies, and they went everywhere and caused chaos. You would go to a show and the pit would be all the Nazi guys. And pretty much you were gonna get hammered if you got in the pit. So we would group up and go and get hammered, you know? So as like a 13, 14 year old kid being threatened by people, it powered my need to get brotherhood and to be in a group where I wasn't afraid anymore, where I wasn't afraid to say that I didn't like what you were saying. And then Mike came from Minneapolis area. ARA was getting started.
Anti-Racist Action, or ARA, was the collective brainchild of the anti-racist skinhead group, the Minneapolis Baldies. ARA organized first regionally, and then in 1988 or 89, made their first trip to Portland. Local skinheads and activists welcomed the support of the Baldies, who came to help organize and were a big influence on the local scene. When Michael refers to when Mike came to town, he's talking about Mike Crenshaw, my co-host.
ARA used to meet in the apartment next door to mine downtown, and then we would all party. Some of that rubbed off on me, and Mike's brother moved out, and he and I became best friends. And it's a crazy thing that just seems totally implausible, but your own belief system coincides a little bit with this person's, and theirs rubs off on you, and they're stronger and tougher. You want to emulate them, and that is, especially when you're young, how your belief systems evolve, right? It's like what you choose to be exposed to, what your parents expose you to. I definitely got introduced to a lot of more political ideas. I'm not going to be here and act like I was altruistic or something. That anti-racist mindset rubbed off on me from the people I was around who understood that it was a more serious issue. I bought into that, and I was more than happy to go help make a difference. I wasn't like leading the charge that this is some moral and ethical positive thing. I wish that I could say I was. That would be kind of cool, but but that wasn't exactly what happened. There are a lot of skinheads that I've been friends with for a long time since then that were members of ARA and who really worked within the parameters of the beliefs and how to portray yourself and what to get caught doing and what not to get caught doing. Anti-racist action, really political, and politics always made me crazy. I believe in anti-racism 100%, and I believe it takes what it takes. One of the things for me personally that kept me from getting more involved was too many rules. It's what people would nowadays call very woke, right? You couldn't call a girl the B word. You had to be okay with everyone being gay. You had to be okay with everything, which I don't have any issue with. I'm kind of slow, so like I can't get woke all at once. And how woke can you be over the course of 6 months? So maybe I'll say it was morally intimidating. And over time, I needed a place without all the clutter of all the political, like social movement. And then Sharp came around, and then Sharp was kind of the same thing, but you know, you could be violent if it was under these circumstances, and it was totally cool. And so that was a little better. So I tended to gravitate over time from the more political to we're two-tone, we're working class, we're not dealing with your Nazi BS. And if you look at me sideways, I get to punch you in the face. Which was kind of what I needed at the time.
At the onset of the 90s, a Portland chapter of Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice, which you have already heard referred to as SHARP, coalesced out of a crew of kids who had been fighting neo-Nazi skinheads. As Michael noted, these kids were loosely organized. They did not have the intergenerational foundation critique and social diversity of the Coalition for Human Dignity and were less ideological than ARA.
In the early 90s, Sharp Skins held an informal first line of defense against neo-Nazi skinheads, especially in the clubs.
For a hot minute, Sharp and ARA were synonymous as multiracial coalitions of young punks and skins who approached the challenge of anti-racism through directly confronting Nazis in the punk scene. But as 1990 rolled into 1991, Sharps emerged as a unique identity. While Sharpskins worked with the CHD on house defense operations and helped with security at demonstrations organized by various leftist groups, membership in Sharp was loose. They were loyal to skinhead culture and held to a highly particular look. Bomber jacket, Doc Martens, suspenders, button-up shirts, and of course, a shaved head. A consistent feature of Sharp attire was some kind of insignia declaring allegiance to anti-racism. Typically, a Sharp patch featured a stylized Spartan helmet design based on the logo for the UK's Trojan Records.
Like their racist counterparts, Sharps moved through the city in crews looking for fights, though their victims were the white power skinheads who preyed on the vulnerable. Sharps were booted up and ready to go, whenever, wherever.
One of those fighters was China, a punk rocker we've heard from throughout the podcast.
There may have been more organized things that I didn't know about, but as far as I am concerned, it wasn't some highly organized process. It was a group of us that were already, that knew each other and that were already together, that were doing, like, fighting the Nazis in the streets daily. We had no backing, just our own conviction. A couple of the guys were gay. We were also standing up for people in that lifestyle that were getting harassed. At my age and at that time, that's what I kind of understood. We were just anti-fascist. You know, we weren't going around and picking fights. Well, there were some people that might have started fights, but I think we just wanted to be left alone.
The city experienced a distressing spike in neo-Nazi hate crime and violence on the streets and at punk shows following the murder of Mulugeta Seurat. The punks and skins who had been informally standing up to and fighting neo-Nazis started coming together.
I started to see a formation of something that turned into being anti-racist. It was after that you guys came. ARA popped up, Sharp popped up. See, you guys might have been the bringers of Sharp.
So there was a handful of baldies that came out here before I got here.
Yeah, maybe that was it.
We were catalytic in the sense that I think it inspired people to become more militant. That, at least that's how the folklore went.
I was definitely part of anti-racist action, but I was hanging pretty deep with Sharp. I think I would consider myself a Sharp member, but I also don't consider myself a skinhead, if that makes any sense, just because we were together and we were kind of fighting some of the same fight. Back in those days, there were people that were like skinheads, and then they would like jump ship and become anti-racist. So there was a lot of this back and forth. We're talking about young people. And I remember bringing some people that had changed from being Nazis to wanting to be anti-racist. I mean, the Nazis were doing evil stuff. They would even attack each other, you know? So, I mean, I think it was a pretty clear line of right and wrong. So there was actually people that wanted to get out of that.
Sharp had a lot of documentation that really explained a lot of ideology and a lot of why things are a certain way. Anytime, you know, they're bringing people into the fold, you kind of have to have ways to educate them. But I didn't get a lot of that. By the time I really got super involved in things, I think we had reached a point in Portland where it was pretty much just free-for-all chaos.
We were fighting out of what we saw in our heart, what we felt, what we'd experienced. We were reacting in a very visceral and intense gut reaction to violence that was happening.
I can tell you that the people I hung out with, if you brought some Nazi BS to me or the crew that I ran with or the people that we hung around with, you might get your face cut off with a broken pint glass. You might end up getting your head stomped in by 10 guys. You definitely were going to get something broken, and you were going to hear about that what you were bringing to the table was unacceptable. So to have that power back and to not have to walk into a place and eyeball everything that's going on and to step from a position of, am I safe here? Do I need to watch my back here? To anybody who's bringing that, better watch their back, was huge and powerful. And there was a lot of that.
Being someone who has to fight in the street, you know that you have to get in a mental state, right, to be that person. And you can switch. I mean, it's like being, I want to say it's like being a soldier. Because people nowadays are shocked if I were to tell them.
Right.
But if I see somebody or something kind of weird happens, I feel tension.
Yeah.
I'm ready.
Yeah.
You know, and as a mother, I'm ready. But I had to work so hard to step away from that.
There were a lot of riots. 60 Nazis and their girlfriends and them starting something, and then like 80 skinhead anti-fascists, and then the general public joining in and smashing Nazis in the middle of Pioneer Square in an all-out riot. I think that we set a precedence where they weren't tolerated wherever they were at.
There was a group of us, Tran and Fong. She would drive around, and we started like coming at these Nazis because they've been harassing us for years. There was a group of people that were non-white. There was Tawny. Iron was kind of in a different group, but he would like pop in every now and then. There was a group of us that were seriously challenging Nazis, and that felt good, you know?
Yeah.
It felt like I wasn't alone for once, and that when I challenged them, there was going to be somebody behind me, you know?
I always enjoyed smashing racists and setting people in their place. it did get to the point to where if you spouted off some racist ish, if you walk through downtown with an iron cross, you might be in trouble.
I remember Jonathan Mizdachi was driving a van. There was all these skinheads downtown, and I remember driving up this gas station. I saw these dummies, like skinheads, standing there, and I was like, "Are you White Pride?" He was like, "Yeah, I slapped him." "Are you White Pride?" "Yeah, I slapped him." "Are you White Pride?" "I slapped him." Slapped all three of them. Jumped back in the van and drove away. I mean, we were on such a high, coming into our like who we were, and like, no, this is not gonna work. That was a good feeling. I mean, I don't want to glorify violence.
As the Sharps put the Boneheads more and more on the run, escalation was inevitable. Here's M. Treloar from the Coalition for Human Dignity.
So the Boneheads fought with fists and knives. And then eventually, when they became more organized, they were told and they learned, oh, if we're going after these people, somebody's got to bring a gun. I would say that they armed up way before we did. It's also inevitable in neo-fascist organizing is to go from, we're going to give a speech here, to we're going to come after people with guns, because they're not going to win in a public debate unless sooner or later they bring out the guns. They replicated that here in Portland fairly rapidly, going from a bunch of teenagers with baseball bats to a bunch of teenagers with AK-47s and 45s. Early on, at one of the apartment buildings that Sharp Skins were sleeping at, a group of Nazi boneheads rolled up with guns and attempted to break in. And if they'd gotten in, they probably would have killed some of them then and there. One of the Sharp crew, a 15-year-old woman, jumped out in front with a can of mace and just pepper sprayed everybody, all of the boneheads and a bunch of her people. At that point, we assisted Sharp in getting some weapons for purposes of defense.
Music journalist Patrick Mazza, who wrote for the left-wing Portland Alliance newspaper, shares a sense of the larger Portland scene and touches on some of the increasing tension between Sharps, the police, and the response of some of their allies.
This is what I wrote then. But while ARA has been moving against racists, its activities are being overshadowed by one of its allied groups, the Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice, also known as the Sharps. The national organization has had a local chapter here for about 6 months, but over recent months, Sharps and racist skinheads have been involved in a number of fights. Most weekends lately, relations between the two factions have been punctured by brawls and beer bottles tossed through windshields, says Lauren Christensen, a Portland police gang enforcement officer. Just who is inciting violence is a subject of conflicting stories. Christensen said the last 3 weekends in April, also physical conflict between racist skins and Sharps. He says Sharps started the violence the first 2 weekends, while the racists began it on the 3rd weekend. That sequence, which occurred on April 27th and April 29th, saw a group of racist skins attack an apartment at Southeast 32nd and Belmont, where Sharps live. "We've been getting attacked by Nazis," Sharps spokesperson Mark Newman maintains. "Police, quote, are trying to make us look like bad guys." Newman says the Sharps are not a criminal gang. "We're an organization that has banded together to fight racism." You have Karen Kiel from ARA. Kiel believes Sharp members should now step back from confrontation with racist skinheads and let other anti-racists take care of the job. Mazzocchi, that was Jonathan Mazzocchi of Coalition for Human Dignity, who believes that the media has overemphasized the Sharps, comments, "They are part of a much larger anti-bigotry youth movement. So far, police and other forces in the city have defined their relation to that movement as adversarial."
Sharp was also constantly harassed by the Portland Police Bureau, who targeted the Sharps but maintained a mostly hands-off approach to addressing behavior of racist skinheads. The gang enforcement team reported an escalation of dangerous youth gang activity rather than coordinated, sophisticated efforts to confront racists who enjoyed political and financial support locally and nationally. The media and thus the public ate it up. This put the Sharps in the limelight as gangsters and deprived them of the civic support of the very people they were struggling to protect, not unlike today's Black Lives Matter protesters. Meet John Baer, who was an activist and Sharp member from Southeast Portland.
A lot of the guys who were involved in the racist groups were
pretty typical white guys that you see in your neighborhood. And they weren't very different than what we see with the Proud Boys and the Patriot Prayer types, more so the Proud Boys. They had a similar relationship with the police in that they seemed to be preferred. I believe the police exist to protect the powerful, and our groups existed to protect those who don't have power. But white supremacy is not a threat to the police. Some racist groups, when they get a bunch of weapons and they want to go after the police, are a threat. But for the most part, people who hold racist views, that's not a threat to law enforcement.
Jonathan Mazzocchi from the Coalition for Human Dignity addresses ongoing frustrations with persistent police mischaracterization of anti-fascist youth.
When we were doing this work, the Portland Police Bureau and the state cops treated all of this stuff as gang activity. They understood everything through this very narrow lens of law and order and gangs. An anti-racist action, multiracial group that was fighting racists in the street. They were one gang, and the East Side White Crowd or whoever was another gang. We, of course, had a very different perspective on this. There was one officer in particular, Lauren Christensen, in the Portland Police Bureau, who was the point person on all of this. He was, I think, the most important person in the state gang task force, within which a lot of the police intelligence was collected on the racist right and on anti-racist action and skinheads against racial prejudice. And Christensen was their guy. He repeatedly, in these early years, in the late 1980s and early 1990s, would attack anti-racist action and skinheads against racial prejudice as being violent gangs, no better than the racists, that this was angry youth. And it created an environment within which it was okay for the far right to attack people of color and to attack Ayer and Sharp activists because this guy's saying it's just a gang thing.
I mean, the police knew about us. They called it. I remember one time I got a call and they didn't know, because I'm black, if I was a skinhead or a blood or a crip. It was so stupid. Like, really?
The police were flat-footed in their response to racist skinheads.
CHD activist M. Trelor recounts an incident.
Laurelhurst Park, Hitler's birthday. The Boneheads had announced that they were going to meet there. So Sharp, ARA, Lesbian Community Project, and Coalition for Human Dignity all said, we'll have a picnic there. Scott Nakagawa and I were there. We went over and talked to some of the other picnickers in the area, asked how everything was going. Everybody said, fine. So we left. Shortly thereafter, 50 cops showed up. They harassed everybody and forced them to leave the park. So there was no reason for that. But then the Oregonian wrote that the Portland police had busted up a neo-Nazi rally in Laurelhurst Park, which they could only have gotten that information from the Portland police and the FBI. We decided we got to do something. They're just continually getting this wrong, and they're deliberately getting this wrong. So they're blurring the distinction between anti-racist skinheads and neo-fascist skinheads, and they're blurring the distinction between those of us who opposed the Nazis and the Nazis themselves. So we responded with an op-ed piece that they printed where we pointed out they had gotten everything wrong. So the Oregonian was embarrassed. They should have been ashamed, and they stopped calling Sharp a gang from thereafter.
The anything goes attitude of the Sharps, combined with their culture of violence, began to wear on the local affiliations. Sharp maintained good allyship with members of the Coalition for Human Dignity, who in turn always stood up for Sharp in public and treated the group overall with respect. But cracks appeared in the bridge between different organizations, and this, at times, made working with the Sharps a challenge. Here's Stephen Gardner of the Coalition for Human Dignity.
Having political strategy conversations with Sharpskins to say, look, you guys are doing great work. Let's look at your overall politics. What about misogyny? What about anti-queer stuff? You know, do you really want that hanging around your neck when you're trying to do this anti-racist work? It's not enough just to be anti-Nazi.
Another Portland Sharp member was Pete Little. In the mid-1990s, homeless and jobless, He moved from a conservative Christian town on the outskirts to Portland, where the blunt, straightforward politics of the skinheads against racial prejudice quickly engaged his deep sense of justice.
There was very little political education in the anti-racist skinhead scene, except for we don't like racists and we don't like Nazis. That's useful and was a draw to me, was a draw to other young folks who just kind of intuitively got anti-fascism and it appealed to them. I think it also had drawbacks. There's a difference between strategic militants and militants for its own sake. Without some political development and political conception, it's very easy to direct that energy in ways that become self-defeating, self-destructive, or just aren't effective.
Sharp was the most visible anti-fascist presence in Portland. The willingness of the Sharps to consistently engage on the most dangerous terrain and put their bodies in the way of hostile threats and real peril gave them a measure of respect from many people. Cecil Prescott offers a reminder to those of us whose work is not on the front lines.
Many times you have these thought-shaping individuals who can make the goals reasonable to a more mainstream audience. And then you have the people who are willing to be right there in downtown, the actors who will be those who are in the middle of the street, in the middle of the action. They're going to be misunderstood and they're going to be mislabeled. That's a reality. That's what's going to happen. The people who are willing to risk are people who should be appreciated.
By 1992, the combined efforts of the anti-racist Portlanders began to turn the tide, at least as far as punk shows and open attacks on the streets. Overt presence of boneheads dwindled. They were not eradicated. Their proliferation today contradicts that fantasy. Even though the boneheads were increasingly scarce, they were still a threat, especially to the Sharps. Neo-Nazis sometimes did drive-bys. Lone Sharps were always at risk of being jumped. As local pressure cleared fascists from the public arena, the fight against neo-Nazis went underground. At parties, rumors of a Nazi skin at a corner store often led to a mass exodus as Sharps jumped into their cars to find the Nazis. They carried the fight to them wherever they went. Drug and alcohol use was widespread across the scene. People were traumatized. They were fighting the neo-Nazis, the cops, and the public opinion. Many also had to deal with personal demons. Even if they had no regrets, there weren't a lot of people who really understood what they were part of, what they'd seen, and what they've done. So they really only had each other. Sharp eventually fractured into several different crews. Pete gives a long look back.
Fascism can't be defeated by a subculture. If a subculture places militants over politics, and politics to me being like the development of the critical capacities of all the participants in the movement to whatever potential they have, but also the ability to have a collective evaluation and engagement on tactics and strategy. It's a long list of folks who brought me up or who came up with me who are now dead, and addiction and trauma and, like, you know, they are pretty significant as the reasons for that. And I can certainly say that a lot of that trauma, addiction, and violence as well was certainly emerged as a consequence of the militarization or the prioritization of violence as a methodology for confronting these folks. And I think that any anti-fascist struggle will be confronted by violence and will have to have a capacity to defend itself. But I think as well, it raises the question of the importance of a social movement that can also care for the people who are wounded by the consequences of that. And I think too, a lot of that violence and a lot of that militance may not have been productive or worthwhile, you know, which is a painful thing to look back on when you think about people you know and love who are no longer here, you know. I think it's easy to glorify militants and confrontation. There will be elements of a struggle to defeat these people that mean that that's necessary, but I think that it's really important to develop a thinking, self-critical movement that really utilizes those tools as sparingly as possible.
Thanks for listening to this episode of It Did Happen Here. The transcripts, show notes with links, full credits, and other relevant content can be found at our website, itdidhappenherepodcast.com. Interviews in this episode were conducted by Selena Flores, Mike Crenshaw, Barbara Bernstein, and Aaron Yankee, and your hosts were Selena Flores and Mike Crenshaw. This podcast is produced by Selena, Mike, and me, Aaron Yankee. Thanks to the participants for sharing their stories. Thanks also to the Institute for Anarchist Studies, to PM Press, to the Marla Davis Fund, to KABU Community Radio, and to the rest of our production team, Icky A., Julie Perini, and Mo Baustern. And thank you for listening.
Fighting for survival is such a boring battle. Wanna get into my car, I wanna drive out to Seattle, where the used record stores have much better prices. But I don't have a car, and I don't have a license.
You are tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Thank you for tuning in to KABU Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4. Now through April, you will...